Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
Great, thanks, Judy. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org and also on Facebook and Twitter and on the club's YouTube channel. Tonight's program is part of the club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also being held in connection with the club's Health and Medicine Forum. I'm Mark Zitter, chair of the Zedema Project, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and of course, your moderator for tonight's program. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guests for this evening, Dr. Dean Ornish, founder and president of the Preventive Medicine Institute, and Ann Ornish, vice president of program development at the Preventive Medicine Institute. Yes, they're married to each other. They also are co-authors of the new book, Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. And as of today, this is a book that is now on the USA Today bestseller list. It's Dr. Ornish's seventh book, and all seven have been bestsellers. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
For more than 30 years, Dr. Ornish and his colleagues at the nonprofit Preventive Medicine Institute, in collaboration with the University of California, San Francisco, and other leading academic institutions, have conducted a series of research studies showing that changes in diet and lifestyle can make a powerful difference in our health and well-being. As a healthcare systems guy, it's also impressed me that his work has influenced and impressed some of the most hard-nosed skeptics around health insurance companies. In fact, since 1993, his program became the first non-surgical, non-pharmaceutical therapy for heart disease that qualifies for insurance reimbursement. Dr. Ornish began conducting his research in 1977 when he was a second-year medical student at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. While studying heart bypass surgery with the famed heart surgeon Michael DeBakey, he wondered what might happen if people addressed the underlying lifestyle factors that often cause coronary heart disease rather than just literally or figuratively bypassing the problem with surgery or medications for their whole lives. After finishing his internship and residency in internal medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, Dr. Ornish moved to San Francisco and founded the Preventive Medicine Research Institute. Ann Ornish created and directs Ornish Lifestyle Medicine's digital platform, known as Empower, which is an online ecosystem for providers, participants, and alumni of Ornish Lifestyle Medicine programs. Ann has over 20 years of advanced training in yoga and meditation. She is a certified integrative health and spirituality practitioner through the California Pacific Medical Center and also received professional training in mindfulness-based stress reduction. So today we're pleased to be joined by these two pioneers in the health field to see how we can all significantly improve our health. Please help me welcome Dr. Dean Ornish and Ann Ornish. It's very nice to have you here. So, Dean, I'm going to start with you, book number seven, and the first one with your wife, I understand.
That's right.
Right. You've written a lot of books. Why this one, and what does it add to your body of work?
Good question. Well, I'm especially proud of this book because it allows me to integrate 40 years of work and to really make it simple. It begins with a quote from Albert Einstein that says, if you can't make it simple, you don't understand it well enough. And so we try to make it radically simple. Eat well, move more, stress less, love more. Boom, that's it. And the more diseases we study and the more underlying biological mechanisms we look at, the more reasons we have to explain why these simple changes are so powerful and how quickly people can get better. And I also present a new unifying theory in this book, which is that, you know, I was trained, like most doctors, to view heart disease as a very different disease than prostate cancer or breast cancer or diabetes or Alzheimer's disease. But the radical theory that I'm presenting here is that they're really the same disease masquerading in different forms, because they all share the same underlying biological mechanisms, things like chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, changes in the microbiome, in telomeres, in gene expression, in angiogenesis, and so on. And each one of these mechanisms, in turn, is directly influenced by what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise we get, and how much love and support we have. And the more diseases we study and the more mechanisms we look at, the more powerful we find these simple changes can be. So we found these same changes. You know, with all this talk about personalized medicine, it was the same lifestyle changes could reverse heart disease, type 2. We were the first to show that it could actually be reversed. When we started doing this work, that was thought impossible. In fact, everything we've done was thought impossible at the time. And that's part of the value of doing research, is we can redefine what's possible. And by doing that, give many people new hope and new choices they didn't have before.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I think that you won't find a lot of people in this audience who would argue about we should eat better, we should move more, and so forth, all those things. But it's hard to do very often, right? So, Anne, I know part of your expertise and what you write a lot about in the book is why we do these things. And I thought you asked a very powerful question. In fact, you talked about the power of the question, which is, why do I want to live longer? And why do you find that a valuable question in getting people to actually actualize some of the things you're talking about?
So it's a very personal question, you know, only each of us can answer for ourselves. But once we have identified why we want to personally live longer, so for each of you right now, if you reflect on what are the most cherished, special moments and people in your life that inspire you to live longer, to be healthy, to thrive. If you can identify those moments, those peak moments, those cherished moments, and people, especially the people, then that is a much more sustainable driver for why we make these choices and continue to make them over time. So to the extent that we can invoke that motivation as we navigate through our daily life, then it's much easier to make the healthy choice whenever possible, mm-hmm. because it's imbued with meaning. And to the extent that we can identify what those motivations are, we really only need one. We probably have many, but to the extent that we identify one and it's sort of like in our quiver, and then we can anchor in that during a moment of temptation, which we all have, is to just take a deep, nourishing breath to reconnect with those seeds of motivations that we've planted for ourselves, then it becomes much easier to make the healthy choice over and over.
Yeah, and to build on that, this goes back to Viktor Frankl's work of, you know, Man's Search for Meaning 50 years ago, with concentration camp survivors. And it wasn't the strongest or the healthiest that survived. It was usually the ones who had the strongest sense of meaning and purpose. I have to survive so that I can whatever, be reunited with my loved ones, bear witness, and so on. But to put your question in a larger context, if it's meaningful, if it's sustainable, and if it's pleasurable, it's sustainable. You know, the old joke, am I going to live longer, or is it just going to seem longer, you know, if I eat and live healthily, it turns out not to be true, that precisely because these underlying biological mechanisms that we talked about a moment ago are so dynamic, when you make changes in lifestyle, to the degree that you make them at any age, most people find they feel so much better so quickly. It reframes the reason for making these changes from fear of dying or fear of something bad happening, which is not sustainable, to joy and pleasure and love and feeling good and meaning and pleasure, which really are. So your brain in just a few hours can get more blood flow. You think more clearly. You have more energy. You can actually grow so many new brain neurons in a process called neurogenesis. Your brain can get measurably bigger. In fact, we're now doing, in collaboration with Dr. Bruce Miller at UCSF and Joel Kramer there and Catherine Madison at CPMC and others, we're actually doing the first randomized trial to see if we can reverse the progression of early-stage Alzheimer's disease because it shares the same underlying mechanisms. My mom died of Alzheimer's. She was a true genius, and it was so devastating to see her lose that. And there are no good drugs for either treating it or for preventing it. So if we can show that, and I think we will, it'll really give millions of people new hope and new choices. Your skin gets more blood. You don't age as quickly. Your heart gets more blood. You can reverse heart disease. Your sexual organs actually get more blood flow in the same way that Viagra works. And so it's not about living longer. It's about living better. We found these same lifestyle changes. We did a study with Craig Venter where we found we could change your genes, turning on the good genes, turning off the bad genes, over 500 genes in just 3 months. You know, people think, oh, I've just got bad genes. there's nothing I can do about it, and actually can do quite a lot. I've been working with Bill Clinton since 1993 when Hillary Clinton asked me to work with the chefs who cooked for them at the White House, and then later Camp David and Air Force One, became one of his consulting doctors. And 9 years ago when his bypasses clogged up, he was told, oh, it was all in his genes and his diet and lifestyle had nothing to do with it. And I sent him an email. I said, it has everything to do with it. Again, not to blame, but to empower. And that's when he began making these changes. We did a study with Elizabeth Blackburn, who got the Nobel Prize, I think who's spoken here, for discovering telomeres, the ends of our chromosomes that control aging. And as we get older, our telomeres get shorter. And as our telomeres get shorter, our lives get shorter, and the risk of premature death from everything, including Alzheimer's, goes up. We found for the first time we could actually lengthen telomeres. And when The Lancet published this, they called it reversing aging at a cellular level. So the more diseases we study and the more mechanisms we look at, these simple changes, you know, people think it has to be a new drug, a new laser, something really high tech. And I think our unique contribution has been to use these very high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art scientific measures to prove how powerful these very simple and low-tech and low-cost interventions can be and how quickly you can feel better when you make these changes.
Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people say, well, okay, this sounds good, but isn't it hard to do in some ways? And your system is not just a diet. It's about diet. It's about exercise. It's about stress reduction. And it's about social connections. Okay, and I think most of us would think, well, those are all important. They're all sort of different, and I have to do different things to make each of those things happen. So part of my question is, like, do I got to do them all? Can I pick just a couple of them? Reversing aging sounds great. Do I need to do it all? So what's the mix and the synergies with it?
Well, let me just kind of give an overview, and I'd like Anne to take it from there. The more you change, the more you improve at any age. That was the – I mean, I thought when I was – first doing these studies that the younger patients who had less severe disease would do better, but I was wrong. It turns out it wasn't how old they were, it wasn't how sick they were. It was simply a function of the more you change, the more you improve both in how you feel, which makes you want to do more. It's like, oh, when I do this, I feel good. When I do that, I don't feel so good, so let me do more of this and less of that, and it comes out of your own experience. But also, the more you change, the more you improve in every way we can measure, whether it's your telomeres, whether it's your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and so on. So if you have heart disease or you have Alzheimer's or if you have early-stage prostate cancer, we did a study with Peter Carroll, who's the chair of urology here at UCSF, and Bill Fair when he was the chair at Sloan Kettering. We found that these same lifestyle changes could slow, stop, or reverse the progression of early-stage prostate cancer. So if you're trying to reverse a life-threatening condition like prostate cancer or heart disease or Alzheimer's, that's the pound of cure. It really does take big changes. That's why we were the first to prove that, because most people didn't go far enough. But if you're just trying to lose a few pounds or get your cholesterol down a few points or whatever, then it's more, the more you change, the more you improve. You want to just take it from there and build on that?
Well, I agree that really this, you can follow our advice because we've done the research, which is comforting. And at the same time, what's most important is to begin experimenting with just a few days. You might feel like stress is the number one thing for you. And so you might want to start with really emphasizing making time to manage your stress for, say, 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes before bed. So you might have a sense of what needs the most attention, and you might want to start there. And as Dean says, to the extent that you can find time for each one of these four equally weighted pillars of your lifestyle, it's going to be so much more beneficial. And then from your own direct experience, to the extent that you can say, gosh, I've always felt chest pain whenever I walk up this hill in San Francisco. And by just doing a little bit more exercise, stress management, you feel like I don't have that chest pain. So then you just start reaffirming that benefit that you're getting from a particular lifestyle choice that you're making, and it becomes self-fulfilling. And that's what really is most meaningful, because we have well-intended spouses, physicians, friends, colleagues that say, this is what you should do. But to the extent that it comes from the inside out and then gets reinforced with your own personal experience, that's the name of the game.
Yeah, and what matters most is your overall way of eating and living. If you're just trying to stay healthy, if you indulge yourself one day, eat healthier the next. You don't have time to exercise one day, do a little more the next. You don't have time to meditate for an hour, do it for a minute, whatever you do. But you know, the whole language of behavioral change has this kind of moralistic, judgmental, shaming, you know, what I call fascist quality. You know, I cheated on my diet. You know, once you call foods good or bad, it's a small step to saying I'm a bad person because I ate bad food. Might as well just finish the burger at that point, you know. And even more than being healthy, people want to feel free and in control. And as soon as I tell somebody, you know, eat this, don't eat that, do this, don't do that, they immediately want to do the opposite. You know, and it goes back to the first dietary intervention, you know, when God said, don't eat the apple, and that didn't go so well, and that was God talking, and apples
we also have teenagers, so we know.
So, you know, be compassionate with yourself. And what matters, you know, just the overall direction is good. Now, if you're trying to reverse disease, it really does take big changes. But if you don't have a life-threatening illness, just to the degree you make these changes, you're going to feel better. And as you feel better, it's going to want to make you do more.
And as you know, there usually is an overemphasis on the diet, this way of eating, because that's, I call it the Trojan horse, because it's the one of the four pillars that you have to do. We have to eat a couple times a day at least. So to the extent that we can address that, find our tricks, our ways of making this way of eating easier and more flavorful and fun, then we get on this moving sidewalk and it gets easier to be like, now I'm feeling better with my energy from what I'm eating. Now I want to get up and move more. Now that I'm moving more, gosh, I really realize that my mind is really busy and not as clear as I'd like it to be. So then there becomes more of an opening for the stress management techniques. And to the extent that we gain more clarity, more inner wisdom access, then it leads us to opening our hearts more. And so the love more component is usually the component that as people are entering the program, they think, is this really important? I mean, this isn't, I don't hear about this in mainstream medicine. What, how important it really is this? And honestly, it becomes the most important, the most not the most important, but really a more sustainable way of transforming your life over time, because it's a little bit more subtle, but highly significant in really moving the behavioral needle. Yeah.
Well, I think something we all hear lots of advice about diet and lifestyle from everybody, from our grandmother to crazy people to doctors. And the fact is, an awful lot of it really doesn't have scientific evidence behind it. And I think the impressive part about your work is that it does have that evidence behind it. So it's harder to argue with data than with your grandmother's.
Well, that's why I think that is what sets our work apart from everyone else's or most people, is that it has the science to back it up. And to me, that's the whole point of science, is to say, you know, what's real, what works, what doesn't, for whom and under what circumstances. And so, you know, all of our studies have been published in the leading peer-reviewed medical and scientific journals, presented at the major scientific meetings. Medicare is now covering our program. It took 16 years for them to review it, and we've gone through the whole gauntlet. We're training hospitals and clinics and physician groups around the country, and it's working. And we're getting bigger changes in lifestyle, better clinical outcomes, bigger cost savings, and better adherence than anyone's ever shown. And we're even finding that one of the cases that we talk about in our new book is a guy who went through our program at UCLA for reversing heart disease, who is a doctor himself. And he was told he had such a massive heart attack that his heart was pumping so poorly, he was told he needed a heart transplant. And while waiting for a donor, he went through our 9-week program, and in 9 weeks, his heart got so much better, he didn't need a heart transplant anymore. So, like, what's the more radical intervention here, a heart transplant or eat well, move more, stress less, love more?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was very taken with some of the dramatic examples in your book, and one of the interesting facts you mentioned was that some people think that a good barometer for men in terms of overall health is erections.
Yes.
And you tell a very interesting anecdote about the making of a documentary called The Game Changers, produced by James Cameron of the Titanic and so forth. Tell us about that little anecdote.
Well, Louis Saihoyos, who actually made that, is here tonight. And so, Louis, can you stand up just for a second? Are you here?
Oh, there
he is,
right
in the front row.
Congratulations.
I can't see you. I'm blinded here. So Louis is, I think, the premier documentary filmmaker in the world, and I'm not just saying that because he's here. He made The Cove, which his first documentary, The Cove, got an Academy Award about the dolphin slaughter in Japan. And it showed the power of raising awareness in this way. And he's totally committed to that. And then he made a film called Raising Extinctions, which was seen by 4.4 billion people around the world. I mean, just crazy. And the third one was called Game Changers, and it was done in collaboration with James Cameron, the legendary filmmaker who did, you know, Avatar and Titanic and Terminator, all those great movies. And the Camerons, he and his wife Susie, became vegan about 9 years ago because he's not only a filmmaker, he's also an explorer. And he learned that more global warming is caused by eating livestock than all forms of transportation combined. And so, and I used to get in arguments, friendly arguments with Al Gore about that, and Al Gore actually became a vegan, even though he's a cattle rancher, not just because of me, but because he realized that, you know, that's where you can really make a difference. Mm-hmm. So the biggest misconception that most people have about eating a plant-based diet is that you're a wimp and you don't get enough protein, right? So he got all these elite athletes, he and Louis got all these elite athletes, and they raised their game, that, you know, bodybuilders, mixed martial artists, heavyweight boxing champions, Olympic medalists, NFL players, and so on. But there's one great scene in there that has these three athletes in their probably mid-20s, and I've been writing for years that even a single meal that's high in animal protein and fat and cholesterol can reduce blood flow to your heart, but that didn't really get people's attention. But what they found was that they gave these three athletes a single meat-based meal. And it was high-quality meat. It was grass-fed beef and organic chicken and so on. And then at night, a urologist named Aaron Spitz wrote, measured with his device, we'll talk about it later, the frequency and the hardness of their erections at night. Because when guys sleep, they get erections. It's just a normal phenomenon. And then they repeated that the next day with a single plant-based meal. And what they found, to everyone's surprise, was that after the plant-based meal, they had 300 to 500% more frequent erections and 10 to 15% harder erections after one meal. In fact, according to Louis, the film crew became vegan after shooting this scene. But it's a perfect example, and I talk about this in the book, because it shows, again, most people think, like, you know, why would I want to change my diet? I want to have fun. And, you know, if I live to be 86 instead of 85, you know, who cares, you know? But to me, there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better and quickly. And when you realize that, okay, I like eating meat, but boy, I like having sex even more. You know, as Aaron Spitz said, you know, what's good for your meat is good for your meat. Your meat, or the meat's not good for your meat. Sorry. Then it really reframes that. But again, and also when people have erectile dysfunction, which is really epidemic in this country, that's one of the most predictive things of having heart disease because it's a systemic illness. It's already throughout your body. And in your brain, it causes dementia or even Alzheimer's, you know, because of the inflammation. So when it's just a microcosm of what's happening in your body as a whole. When you eat well, move more, stress less, love more, everything works better in the ways that often matter most.
And this is really important for the younger generations. As we've been out talking about the book and people say, well, I don't have a disease that I'm looking to reverse. I feel like I'm young, I'm healthy. And so two things that Dean just said. One is what's good for you is good for the planet. And feeling like in this time where it feels so overwhelming to think about what can I, one person, do to contribute to climate change. And actually the way you eat is way more powerful than even the form of transportation. So that is very empowering at any age. And secondly is the way that these underlying mechanisms affect blood flow, and whether it's your sexual function at really any age, but especially even at a younger age when you feel like you're bulletproof. Those are the kinds of things that, because these changes and the benefits occur so quickly, that for somebody who's even young, that at these elite athletes are getting their competitive edge with their performance, whether it's athletic, it's the same with students. It's well documented how children who just exercise at school, they perform better in school. They learn better. They have better test grades. So it's as well as depression. You know, I think that's the other thing that's earlier on the curve towards chronic diseases. Yeah, we see depression and exercise again, but overall our lifestyle has shown that it not only can help prevent depression, but also treat it.
And it cuts depression scores in half. It works actually better than antidepressants, but the only side effects here, like all these things, are good ones. I was on the board of the San Francisco Food Bank for several years, and I was shocked because to hear that one out of five kids in the Bay Area goes to bed hungry, even this affluent country, an affluent city that we live in. Now, that's just pitiful. But it turns out that it takes 14 times more resources to make a pound of meat-based protein than plant-based protein. So if more people were to not become vegan necessarily, but just, you know, have a meatless Monday, you know, or just, you know, a meal or two, as Anne was saying, it frees up so many more resources. There's enough food to feed everybody. No one need go hungry. And so, as Anne said, you know, when you can imbue those choices with meaning, like, oh, I'm choosing not to eat meat today so I can feed the hungry, so I can help global warming. There's something I can do about that, as well as helping my family and my erectile dysfunction or whatever people have. It imbues those choices of meaning. So instead of saying, oh, I can't have that, I'm feeling deprived, you're saying, I'm choosing not to eat certain foods because just the act of choosing not to do that imbues those choices with meaning. That's why all spiritual traditions and all religions have dietary guidelines, even though they're often in conflict with each other, because whatever the intrinsic benefit is of eating or not eating certain foods, just reframing that to say, I'm choosing not to eat certain foods because it makes my life more meaningful, makes it much more sustainable.
All right, well, you're persuading me that I should eat better, and there's a lot of reasons for it, you know, but it's hard to do. It's a little story about a guy walks into a bar, orders three beers, and the bartender says, you want all three at once? And the guy says, yeah, I just moved here from out of town, and I used to do construction with my brothers, and we'd always go out for a beer afterwards. I miss him, so this one's for Danny, this one's for Bobby, this one's for me. Bartender says, fine. He pours the three beers. Next day, same thing. Next day, 6 months goes on, same thing. One day, the guy walks into the bar. The bartender starts pouring his beers, and the guy says, just two beers today, Joe. And the guy turns around and says, what happened? What's wrong? And the guy says, oh, don't worry. Nothing's wrong. My brothers are fine. I just decided to give up drinking. and that joke really hit home for me because I'm really good at fooling myself about food and, oh, it's not so bad. I'm not eating that much. I'm going to exercise later or something like that. And you had some great things in the book about really practical, tactical strategies for eating better. If you're at someone's house, if you're at a restaurant and other people aren't eating well, what do you do? And you had some good ideas about that.
Well, I'm sure if many people who have read the book or are just sitting here right now are thinking, well, okay, this all sounds good, but what am I going to do when I go out to eat with my colleagues, my friends, my family? And so one of my favorite parts of the book is how to order from any restaurant, any menu, and eat well. And it's actually, to keep it simple, what I like to do is just look at the menu and, of course, it's, almost 2020, and most restaurants, even in the most rural areas, have vegetarian and vegan A option on the menu. And when there's not, or you don't even like that option, my go-to is to look at what they have in the sides, because those are usually their freshest vegetables, legumes, other kinds of sides. And then I'll say, either can I get these three things on one plate, or can you ask the chef to do whatever they would like with the freshest vegetables? And we always laugh because when we're out with people and they say, well, I didn't see that on the menu when it comes out, because we try to be discreet. Don't want to draw a lot of attention to yourself, especially being us, because people think we're going to be the food police that go out with us. But so we try to keep it discreet. And then when they bring out the plates, they're like, what? What did you order? I didn't see that on the menu. And it's like when Harry met Sally. We're like, oh, can I just get one more of what she has?
I'll have what
she
has.
So it actually is a lot of fun. And it makes dining out always new and exciting. So that's one of the things. I think the other thing that's so important is to set yourself up for success. So in all the lifestyle pillars, to the extent that you can incorporate blocks of time in your daily schedule and your calendar to support your lifestyle goals. So for me, like 15 to 30 minutes of meditation in the morning and as I'm ending my day has not just become a nice to have, but it's become a need to have. In order for me to function the way that I need to, I've become to really rely on that. And so likewise, the walk in the middle of the day or that kind of mid-afternoon when I start to have a slump, I come to have relied on it. It might have been hard in the beginning to pull myself out, and sometimes it is from work to extract myself and to swivel, but it always is so rewarding. So the first time, I felt like, okay, I have more energy to go back and resume work. And it keeps getting more and more so that it's like, okay, is it time for my walk yet? Okay, 5 minutes. Okay, 2 minutes, 1 minute. And now it's, even the people around you are like, aren't you supposed to be taking that walk right now? Because you're a lot easier to get along with in the afternoon or a lot more creative. So I think that scheduling these blocks of time it sounds obvious, but actually if you make the time and then you protect it, just like any other meeting or appointment, then you're that much more likely to succeed.
So creating a habit.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Same time, same, mm-hmm. Each day.
Now, I know going back to diet, it's interesting when I talk to people about diet or hear people talk about diet, it seems that most people, when they think about diet, it's for weight control, right? People want to weigh less. And there's generally an assumption, which is stated or unconscious or whatever, that that's also healthier. But I read in the book that it's not necessarily true. You can have a diet that helps you lose weight that actually might be not healthy for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I debated Dr. Atkins many times before he died, and the autopsy report, which was made public, showed that he died of heart failure. And the diets that have happened since then are just Atkins redux, you know, the paleo diet, the keto diet. Yeah, you can lose weight on them, but you can lose weight in lots of ways that aren't really healthy. You can lose weight by smoking cigarettes or chemotherapy or amphetamines are all good ways of losing weight. Getting severely depressed is a good way to lose weight, but I don't recommend it. Because what you want to do is lose weight in a way that enhances your health rather than mortgaging it. And there was a wonderful study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine by Stephen Smith that reviewed this literature, and it showed that what happens in your arteries on different diets, not just in your heart, but throughout your body, on a Whole Foods plant-based diet like we recommend, they're clean. On a standard American diet, they're partially clogged. On an Atkins, keto, paleo diet, they're severely clogged, even if they lose weight, or even sometimes if their risk factors go down, because the risk factor is only important to determine what's going on in your arteries. And so, I'm really done with those diet wars now. And in the book, we're saying, look, it works. We've been doing this for 40 years. In every way we can measure, it works. And unfortunately, there are no studies showing that these other diets can reverse disease. In fact, the studies that have been done show that they significantly increase your risk. And it goes past the fat versus carbs debate to the animal protein itself. That studies that are showing that diets that are high in animal protein, you have a 75% increased risk of premature death from all causes, and a 400 to 500% increased risk of premature death from type 2 diabetes, prostate, breast, and colon cancer, independent of the whole fat versus carbs thing. And the other thing that I think, just to kind of segue into another area, because Ann mentioned the love more, is that the real epidemic isn't just obesity or heart disease. It's loneliness and depression and isolation. And study after study have shown that people who are lonely and depressed and isolated are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely from pretty much everything when compared to those who have a sense of love and connection and community. And I don't know anything in medicine that has that kind of impact, in part because of the breakdown of the social networks that used to bring us together. You know, 50 or 60 years ago, most people had an extended family or a neighborhood with 2 or 3 generations of people or a church or synagogue they went to regularly or an extended family they saw. And many people today don't have any of those things. And what we're learning is that the reason why those things were so protective is that we've survived as a species as a way of being together. But one of the studies that I quote in the book is that the more time you spend on Facebook, the more depressed you're likely to be. And the reason for that is that it's not real intimacy. You know, looks like everybody has this perfect life but you. You know, it's like, because you don't post your demons and your dark side and your doubts and your, you know, all the bad stuff that happened. Whereas if you grow up in a family with 2 or 3 generations of people, it's like, I see you. I don't just see your Facebook profile and your bio sketch. I see where you messed up. And you know that they know, and they know that you know that they know, and they're still there for you. And there's just something really primal about being seen, warts and all, and having them there. So in the support groups in our study, they're not just helping people stay on the diet. We're creating a safe place to recreate that sense of allowing people to let down their emotional defenses, talk openly and authentically about what's really going on in their lives without fear that someone's going to judge them or criticize them or give them glib advice. And just to say, let's connect with our feelings. You know, and it's so easy to make fun of this. Oh, it's so touchy-feely. And I used to get defensive and say, oh, no, look at our PET scans and our quantitative arteriograms and our radionuclide ventriculograms and blah, blah, blah. And I thought one day, I said, you know, it is touchy-feely. That's what makes it work so well. You know, we are touchy-feely creatures. We're creatures of community. And I've learned that it's not enough to give people information. I mean, we're drowning in information. You know, can do a Google search and a million documents in like a 0.6 seconds, you know. Everybody who smokes cigarettes knows it's bad for them. It's on every package of cigarettes. So I'd ask people, like, why do you smoke or overeat or drink too much or work too hard or abuse substances? And they'd say, because they help us deal with our depression, our loneliness, our unhappiness. I've had patients say things like, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes, and they're always there for me, and nobody else is. You're going to take away my 20 friends? What are you going to give me? Or food fills the void, or fat coats my nerves and numbs the pain, or opioids. We have a big opioid epidemic. It's just a subset of that numbs the pain, or video games, or whatever. And so we're presenting these techniques not just to manage stress, although they certainly help you do that, but the ancient swamis and rabbis and priests and monks and nuns didn't develop these techniques just to unclog their arteries or perform better in sports or whatever. It can do all those things, but we're presenting something that's more radical than that in this book, that when you practice meditation in whatever form, secular or religious, your mind quiets down. And when your mind quiets down, you experience more of an inner sense of peace. And to realize that's our natural state, is to be peaceful and healthy. It's not something we get from outside of ourselves. It's who we are already. And not being mindful of that, we often think, oh boy, if only I had more money, more power, more beauty, more accomplishment, if only I could make a bestseller list, whatever, then I'd be happy. Now, once you set up that view of the world, if you don't get it, you feel bad. If someone else gets it, you feel really bad. It makes you feel like we live in this zero-sum game. The more you get, the less there is for me. But ultimately, even if you get it, it's really fun for a little bit, but then it's either now what, it's never enough, or so what, big deal. Now, if you take it even further, you get this transcendent experience that on one level we're separate, on another level we're part of something larger that connects us all, whatever name you give to that. It's the antithesis of the other, you know, that we're seeing unfortunately so much in our political realm now. Once you see people as being separate and only separate, then bad things happen. Though those Muslim terrorists, those Mexican rapists, whatever, just to cite a few examples, not to mention any names. And then you can do bad things to them because they're different from you. But to me, the essence of all spiritual traditions is love and compassion and forgiveness and it's of others and yourself, and it naturally comes from having that transcendent state that, you know, we are all connected on one level. We are that light behind the projector that manifests in all these different names and forms. And it's in my limited experience, that's where the healing can be the most powerful. And our work is all about treating the underlying cause, and we can talk about, you know, diet and behaviors and so on, but ultimately, to have that direct experience of that transcendent oneness is where, to me, even the word healing comes from the root to make whole, and yoga from the Sanskrit, union. These are really old ideas that we're rediscovering.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
And to build on that, as far as, again, what moves the behavior needle. So to the extent that we have self-awareness, self-care, and self-love. So when we talk the stress less and the love more, the techniques that we recommend for an hour per day for someone trying to reverse their disease, that's when we get to quiet down and get in touch with what are those underlying causes that are driving our behaviors, which have maybe led to the chronic diseases in our family history and perhaps in our own lives already. So that is the kind of pulling back the layers of the onion, the veils of awareness to get to what, why am I really doing something that I know isn't serving me well?
How do I continue to do that? The still small voice within you do that so eloquently.
Thank you. You do it so well, but I'll borrow from you. Well, we all have this still, quiet voice inside of us. That's the beautiful thing. It's not like my wisdom is greater than your wisdom. This is something that we're all born with. And to the extent that we can regularly quiet down and get still in our body, that inner wisdom, as Dean talks about, as the still, quiet voice within, I often am very in touch with it when I wake up at some point in the middle of the night. It's one of my cherished moments of meditation, actually. In the rush of a day, it might take me 15, 20, 30 minutes to get to that insight, to that core thing. And in the middle of the night, it's right there. It's sometimes the thing that wakes me up. And I'm so grateful to then hold space for it and to ask, tell me more. What else am I not paying attention to? What else do I really need to attend to at this time in my life? And it's a very intimate relationship that we can each have with ourselves. And to the extent that we have that intimate, authentic relationship with ourselves, then we're opening ourselves up in the love more component to be received and met by others in our lives with a more authentic connection.
And then we're more likely to make lifestyle choices that are life-enhancing than ones that are self-destructive. And all of the studies that I've done came from that little voice. You know, it's someone says, hey, Dean, listen up, pay attention, you're not doing something. So I've learned at the end of a meditation to ask, what am I not paying attention to that I need to pay attention to? So it'll say, do an Alzheimer's study, you know. It's not like this incremental thing in the like eureka. It's more like I have this insight, which comes from that inner voice, that still small voice within, the guru within, the God within, whatever name you want to give to it, even it doesn't matter. And then kind of reverse engineer to see if that's true.
So I think it's notable. A lot of people say, well, I can't meditate for 15 or 30 or 60 minutes a day because I'm too busy. So I challenge you to tell me how you're busier than this couple is traveling all over the world, writing books and running around.
Well, you know, even sometimes I'll say, you know, I don't have time to meditate for 20 minutes. And I'll say, well, do I have time to meditate for a minute? And if I have to admit that I don't have time for a minute, then I have to admit my life is so out of balance that I'd rather just do the minute. And once I do the minute, chances are I'm going to do more because, you know, it's just getting started. But, you know, even a minute, I mean, have you ever found yourself listening to a song on the radio in the morning and finding yourself humming it later in the day? It's the same thing with meditation. Even a minute, it carries with you. And people say things like, you know, I used to have a short fuse and I'd explode easily. My fuse is longer now. Things just don't bother me as much. And so I can actually get more done without getting stressed in the process.
So we can't always change the stressors in our life. We have the same job, the same drivers, but we can change how we react to it, how we relate to it and respond. We have so much more choice, in fact, than we often believe. And that's what gets very empowering. It's like driving to work on the same path every day and hitting that pothole. It's like, oh, I can't believe I hit it again. It's like stress can be very repetitive, and we can become self-judging when we don't evolve in the way that we're responding to stress. It feels like it's the tail wagging the dog. It's happening to us.
And then one day you say, I can actually drive around that pothole. I don't have to.
Or maybe I'll take a different street. So it actually can become quite playful and fun.
Great. I've got a number of audience questions, a lot of wonderful questions. I promise you I won't get to all of them. There's too many, but I appreciate the questions. So there's several about specific things that we might eat or drink, and they want commenting on them.
Sure.
Here's three. Alcohol, fish, and salt.
They go very well together, actually. It's like what Mark Twain said, if I give up wine, he said to his doctor, if I give up wine, women, and song, will I live longer? He goes, no, but it'll seem longer. He goes, well, I may give up singing if I have to choose. wine, salt, and fish.
Alcohol, yeah.
Alcohol. So alcohol, we don't prescribe it, we don't proscribe it. The studies used to show that people who had one or two drinks a day actually lived longer than those who didn't drink at all or who drank more than that. It turns out that was an artifact, that a lot of the people that didn't drink at all because they were so sick. But when they corrected for that, it didn't really matter. But again, I think that these are personal choices. Clearly, if you drink more than two drinks a day, you're increasing your risk of a number of bad things. You know, here in California, where marijuana is legal, I think, you know, how many marijuana overdoses were there last year in the state of California? Like zero, right? Because the ratio of therapeutic to toxic is like 300 to 1. With alcohol, it's more like 10 to 1. So I think if you had to choose, more people might be considered moving in that direction. Salt is not nearly as bad as most people think unless you have high blood pressure or kidney failure, because salt causes your body to hold on to water, which in turn raises your blood pressure. And if you don't have good kidneys, then it tends to cause you to be more volume overloaded. But for other people, it's really not nearly as a big a deal. But on the other hand, if you eat less salt, you begin to prefer foods that are less salty. You know, your palate adapts. And that's one reason why, in some ways, it's easier to make big changes in diet, because if you eat healthy most of the time, you prefer foods that taste that way. And the third is fish. Fish are definitely better than chicken or beef in terms of in the hierarchy of things. But there are no clean fish in the world, really. All fish are contaminated with mercury, dioxin, PCBs. And the bigger the fish, the more of the toxins that they have. So if you're not going to be on a you know, purely plant-based diet, a pescatarian diet would be the next best thing. But if you can move into a plant-based diet, it's even better.
Right. We have a question here that there seems to be a lot written these days about personalized health and medicine, the polygenics, proteomics, microbiome, things like that. So how important is this personal set of issues versus the big four things that you mentioned?
Yeah, I was on Craig Venter's board of his nonprofit for several years, and we've been friends for 20 years, and we used to get in these debates about this, friendly debates as well. If you're talking about a personalized treatment for a pancreatic tumor using immunotherapy, that's awesome. But for the vast majority of chronic diseases, what this is, goes along with this unifying theory that we talked about earlier, it wasn't like we found there was one set of diet and lifestyle recommendations for reversing heart disease, a different one for prostate cancer, a different one for all these different chronic diseases. It was the same for all of them because they are really all the same disease in different forms. They have the same underlying biological mechanisms. And that makes it really radically simple. You don't, now, you can personalize around the edges, you know, if someone's gluten sensitive and so on, but it's one also one of the reasons why you find these comorbidities. People have high blood pressure and heart disease and high cholesterol and obesity because they're just doing that. But, you know, if you look at China 50 or 60 years ago, they had the heart disease was and these chronic diseases were so much rarer there, even though they have the same genetic diversity. In other words, people say, well, carbs, you know, I'm more sensitive to carbs or I'm more sensitive to fat. But if you're not eating that much refined carbs or fat, then those differences don't matter. Chris Gardner did a study at Stanford last year in the journal of the AMA where he tried to tailor the diets based on that and found that they actually lost the same amount of weight. It didn't really matter. So you can do a little bit of fine tuning, but for the in the vast majority of issues, it's really the same lifestyle changes that can reverse and prevent all of these different conditions. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to guess that some people, as they listen to what you're saying, are reasonably healthy and want to stay that way. And some people have some serious diseases and they want to consider truly reversing them, you know,
yes.
Which and the latter might be more motivated. But still, they might say, how am I going to make these changes? And you write a bit about the pros and cons of doing it all at once versus a gradual transition into some of these lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
Which do you think is a better approach?
Well, it depends. The two basic strategies that we found enable people to make sustainable changes. And by the way, this idea that taking a pill is easy and everybody can do it and changing diet and lifestyle is really hard is not what the data shows. Studies show, the pharma company's own data show that half to two-thirds of people who are prescribed cholesterol-lowering drugs like Lipitor are not taking them after just 4 to 6 months, and a third of the prescriptions never even get filled. And people say, and yet we're getting, you know, we've been training hospitals and clinics and physician groups around the country, and we're getting 85 to 90% of the people finish the 72 hours, and a year later, about 85 to 90% of people are still following it. And people say, that's crazy. You mean it's taking a pill is so much easier? You're getting better results than that? How can that be? And the reason is that taking the pill doesn't make you feel better if you're a cholesterol-lowering drug, but changing lifestyle does. And again, it's more fear-based. Take this pill. It's not going to make you feel better. Hopefully, it won't make you feel worse to prevent something really awful from happening years down the road, like a heart attack or stroke that people don't want to think about, so they generally stop doing it. But when you change your lifestyle, for someone who can't, who's got bad heart disease and they can't walk across the street without getting pain or make love with their spouse or play with their kids or go back to work without getting chest pain, and within a few days to a few weeks, they can do all of those things, they usually say things, you know, I like eating junk food, but not that much because, again, what I gain is so much more than what I give up. So one strategy is to make big changes all at once because you feel so much better so quickly and it comes from your own experience. That really makes it sustainable. The other is to make small, gradual changes. If you indulge yourself one day, eat healthier the next. If you're just trying to prevent disease, that's a valid approach as well. So if you're just trying to reverse disease, the pound of cure, you really do need to make big changes all at once. If you're just trying to stay healthy, to the degree you make these changes, there's a corresponding benefit. But what matters most is your overall way of eating and living.
And again, setting yourself up for success is not only scheduling those blocks and the recurring blocks in your schedule for this, but also to join forces, because life is, number one, to be enjoyed, and number two, to be at least shared. That's how we get the joy out of it. So to the extent that we can each think of somebody in our lives that we would like to invite to join us for regular walks or to join us for a meal, we should, to whatever extent is possible, to never eat alone. It slows us down. It allows us to appreciate the food, have more nourishment, and company along the way. And so for whatever it is, this lifestyle in general, if to the extent that you're able to team up with somebody, it's like having a trainer, but you don't have to pay. Sometimes you will do things for people that we love that we wouldn't do for ourselves.
And Paul Dudley White once said, walk your dog whether you have one or not.
You note in the book that, then we mentioned earlier, that the single biggest influence on loneliness, on survival and health and well-being is loneliness.
Yes.
Entry. And that goes to the love more part of your book. And you talked about the need there. But what's the prescription? What do we do to love more?
Well, I want to make sure that although it can include romantic love, that this is by no means, when we talk about loving more, it really has to start from the inside. So it's goes beyond, first of all, it has to happen. We have to have compassion and self-care for ourselves. And that's really the only way. We can't hijack that. Once we start making choices to love ourselves more, we invite in others to meet us there. And so to the extent that you can find start with where you are. Who are the friends, the family members that you have right now? Of course, we can all go out into our community and find a class at a community center, a yoga center, and we attend that regularly so we can build community. But at the same time, we all have family and friends. And to start there and to think about, are there, if there's been a rift or a misunderstanding, taking the time to mend that, to hear one another's feelings. You probably need to feel that you need to be heard. I'm sure the other person feels they need to be heard. That elicits healing and mending that then can allow us to reconnect anew with ourselves and others. It's, again, it seems so subtle, like, oh, I don't care about that. It was a long time ago. I don't really care about my parents anymore or what have you till the next holiday. But to the extent that we can first start with ourselves and love ourselves, then we're really giving people permission around us to love ourselves, and then to start with the people that we know. Yeah. This is something we can all do.
Yeah, and the heart pumps blood to itself first so that it can then pump blood to the rest of the body. Is that selfish or unselfish? You know, if you love yourself, you have that much more love to give. You can't give what you don't have. I also want to mention before I forget that, as I mentioned, we're doing this Alzheimer's study to see if we can reverse Alzheimer's, and we're still recruiting patients. So if anyone's listening to this, just go to ornish.com, our website. It's all for free. And Louis is actually making a film on that. So if anybody's interested in supporting that film, we're going to give it away to schools and training institutions and so on as a way of really raising awareness of what a powerful difference these simple changes can make in people's lives.
Actually, I had someone who asked, said, do you want me for your Alzheimer's study? So I'll save this card for you.
Here, thank you.
Pretty question saying, if you are vegan but occasionally cheat, is that okay?
No, you're going straight to hell.
Okay, next question.
Next question. Actually, there's an old joke. If you don't have to ask if someone is vegan, they will tell you.
Probably true. What do you think about increasing intake of good fats and limiting carbs?
Well, the thing that Dr. Atkins and I and the paleo and, you know, keto and whatever diets agree on is that Americans eat too many refined carbs, too much sugar and white flour and white rice and things like that. And the reason why those are bad in the sense of unhelpful, not in a moral sense, is that when you go from whole wheat flour to white flour or brown rice to white rice, you're removing the fiber and the bran. And the fiber and the bran fill you up before you get too many calories. But they also slow the absorption from food from your gut into your blood. So when you eat those foods, your blood sugar goes up slowly, it goes down slowly, you get a nice constant source of energy. But if you eat sugar or white flour, it's like mainlining sugar. Your blood sugar just spikes up. It gets to high levels, your pancreas senses that your blood sugar is too high, it secretes insulin, which makes your blood sugar go down, but it's like a pendulum. If you pull it to one side, it doesn't just stop in the middle, it goes to the other, and then you get that low blood sugar, you crash, and there's a good cure for that, which is more sugary. That's kind of the whole addictive cycle of eating sugar. But also these repeated surges of insulin cause chronic inflammation, which is at the root of so many chronic diseases. And they cause the insulin receptor to downregulate. So you get insulin resistance, which is really what causes type 2 diabetes. And by the way, half of the population today is diabetic or pre-diabetic. It cost $322 billion last year just in the U.S. alone. But when you change your diet and lifestyle, if you eat the good carbs, your body becomes more insulin sensitive. Most people who go on insulin are able to reduce or even get off of it altogether under their doctor's supervision, just like the cholesterol-lowering drugs and their blood pressure pills that they're told they have to take forever. And so you get the feeling like you're actually really getting better when you make these changes, that you can reduce and get off these medications that you were told that you'd have to take forever. So good carbs are fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and soy products in the natural form as they come in nature. So we agree to reduce the bad carbs, but you don't want to replace them with bacon and pork. I'd love to tell you that bacon and pork rinds and sausage are health foods. I grew up in Texas eating them all the time until I was 19, but they're not. You know, it doesn't, should you never eat them? That's your personal choice. But don't kid yourself into thinking they're really good for you because they're not. Mm-hmm. What's that? Well, good fats, you know, are things like olive oil, let's say, and canola oil and things like that. But the studies, you know, there's this, you know, the Gary Tobbses and others say, you know, Americans have been told to eat less fat. They're eating less fat. They're fatter than ever. Low fat is dead. It's all sugar. Well, it's not all sugar. It's not all anything. It's all of these things, number one. Number two, we may have been told to eat less fat, but I went to the U.S. Department of Agriculture database where they actually track the entire U.S. food supply. And every decade since 1950, we've been eating more fat, more carbs, I mean, more fat, more sugar, more meat, and more calories. So not surprisingly, we're fatter, not because we're getting too little fat, because we're eating too much of everything. Now, what about the Mediterranean diet? It's a higher fat diet, and didn't that show that was better than a low fat diet? Well, there's a study called the PREDIMED study in the New England Journal of Medicine. The short version is, they said that the headline was Mediterranean diet better than low-fat diet in preventing heart disease. Well, number one, the quote low-fat diet went from 39 to 37% fat, hardly any reduction at all. They replaced fat with sugar, which is never a good idea. But in fact, they found no difference in heart disease in the two groups. They only found a reduction in stroke rate, because when you have more of the omega-3 fatty acids that you can get in salmon, but you can also get them in the plankton base, the vegan base, which is where the salmon get them from anyway, that reduces blood clots from forming, and 90% of strokes are due to blood clots. So a Mediterranean diet, a higher fat, quote, good fat diet, is certainly better than what most Americans are eating. But even better is a plant-based diet that's low in fat and low in sugar and refined carbs.
I find it fascinating that we have better weight loss data than Weight Watchers. Even though you never set out to have a diet, this was a lifestyle that happened to include a way of eating.
Because, you know, fat has 9 calories per gram and protein and carbs have only 4. I wrote a book 20 years ago called Eat More, Weigh Less, because we found the average person in our studies lost 24 pounds in the first year, but they weren't trying to lose weight, you know, because they were eating more food and more frequently. But because the food is so much less dense in calories, you can eat the same amount of food in quantity and still get a third fewer calories, but you're not hungry because you're eating the same amount of food, and that makes it sustainable.
I love that part of your book where you could actually eat more. You don't have to eat less to lose weight.
That's right.
Yeah. Right, just eat
lose
better.
Lose excess weight and gain health.
Yeah.
All the side effects are good ones.
Which is great. We have several questions from people who apparently are quite convinced about the benefits of a plant-based diet, whole foods plant-based diet, which is great. But they know a lot of other people who are not as well convinced, and they're asking for advice. There's some quick arguments, some quick statistics they can give to their friends and family to show they should really all be eating vegan.
I think the best advice I can give you is wait until you're asked. You know, the best example, the best teacher is a good example. And nobody wants to be proselytized. Nobody wants to be lectured to. And so if people ask you, then, you know, tell them this is what I found really works for me. And then if they ask you even more, then say, well, you know, the studies show that, you know, I mean, look, if you eat a plant-based diet, what's good for you is good for the planet. You know, what's personally sustainable is globally sustainable. So you're eating lower in the food chain, so you're getting, you know, better erections, you're getting better new blood cells growing, blood to your brain, new neurons growing in your brain, your heart disease is reversing, your athletic performance is increasing, you're reducing global warming, and you're feeding the hungry. Okay, that's one camp. The other camp is the opposite, okay? Now, how is it that we got to a place in our country where that's considered normal and this is considered radical? It's like, you know, the studies are showing that after 40 years of doing stents and angioplasties, the randomized trials have shown that in stable patients, they don't work very well. They don't prolong life, they don't prevent heart attacks, and they don't even reduce angina. And yet that's the conventional approach. I mean, when we were trying to get Medicare to cover our program, about halfway through, the head of Medicare at the time said, okay, we'll do a demonstration project, but you have to get a letter from the head of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the National Institutes of Health saying your program is safe for older people. I said, safe compared to getting your chest cut open or having stents put in? He goes, yeah, that it's just safe for older people to walk, meditate, eat vegetables, quit smoking, and love more. I said, you must be joking. And he wasn't. We had to do a whole literature review on that. That's where it's so topsy-turvy. It's like, that's the conventional approach, and this is the radical approach. Even though now, 40 years later, when they finally got around to doing randomized trials, that doesn't work, and this does. And a fraction of the costs, and again, the only side effects are good ones for both you and the people you care about and for the planet. That's my short answer.
Good. That's great.
But only when asked.
Yeah. it's a question. Different kind of a question.
And that's why film is so great, because then you just take them to see one of Louis' films, and then they can just see for themselves. You don't have to say anything.
There's a different question here that may have been brought about by all the conversations about erections, which is what percentage of your research subjects are women?
In the prostate cancer study, zero.
You sexist.
In the Alzheimer's study, it's about 50-50.
Here's a more technical question. What are your thoughts on the supplementation of collagen peptides for gut repair and arthritis and joint treatment, and the potential of collagen peptides being considered as ACE inhibitors? That's a technical one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's part of what I talk about in the book. There's this whole idea that of leaky gut, and there is something to that. But, you know, a lot of the practitioners of functional medicine and other things like that just happen to have all these great supplements that are going to fix that, and thousands of dollars in lab tests and so on. I just don't, you know, I don't criticize anybody for doing that. But the fact is that when you eat a whole foods plant-based diet that's low in refined carbs and the kinds of things we're talking about, particularly when you combine them with the other three aspects of our program, your leaky gut syndrome gets better too. You don't necessarily have to have these expensive supplements and so on to do that. Now, I think I take a few supplements. I think having a good, you know, multivitamin without iron, some omega-3s. I take some curcumin because it can help, because Alzheimer's runs in my family. It helps to increase glutathione, which is helps to rid your body of some of these toxic substances. But for the most part, you know, if you eat and live well, you don't necessarily need a lot of these expensive things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We talked a little bit about stress and about how much, you write in the book, about how much of our culture is all about getting and doing rather than just being. That hit home for me. A friend of mine said to me recently, he said, "Mark, you're not really a human being, you're more of a human doing." I think there was something to that. So you've talked a little bit about some of the stress reduction techniques, but primarily focused on meditation. Great. But Anne, you write about four or five other ones that I thought were very interesting and very, very doable as well. Can you talk about a few other options?
Yeah, the ones that are simple for people.
Yeah. So the five techniques that we've proven to be the most beneficial are gentle stretching. And so we think of yoga at the same time. It's not the type of yoga that is the pretzel type of yoga. This is more of a restorative way of moving slowly, consciously, and finding our edge and sort of massaging our edges with awareness. So another, as we talked about meditation, mindfulness has obviously become better and better documented for its benefits in, you know, Silicon Valley and anyone who is wanting to perform at a high level. But for me also as a mom, meditation, and I know so many other moms out there, it's like me time, it's mama time. And it allows us to be that much more calm and present and loving for those that we love, especially our kids and our family. Imagery is another one. So we can't tell the difference between what we're imagining and what's really happening. And in the first film that came out, it was a train that was coming at people, and everyone in the audience sort of jumped like the train was coming at them. So it's similar when we can imagine positive outcomes. So if we're having a surgical procedure or even an interaction that we're going to have maybe at work or with someone that we care about, we can begin to imagine how it feels to walk through it, to chart out a successful path for ourselves, a healing outcome, a productive outcome. And then it's that much easier to manifest. So again, these are all the things we can do from the inside out. I'll add to that breath awareness. So yes, the largest improvements that we've been able to measure come from people who are practicing these stress management techniques for up to an hour a day. The more that they practice these techniques, the more improvements we've been able to measure. At the same time, that's not possible every day. And I always feel that the breath is the most readily available and powerful tool we have. So when we get stressed, which we all do out there in the car when we're driving home tonight, notice that when stress arises, that our breath pattern becomes a little more shallow and rapid. And so all just by noticing that, becoming aware of that, and then manually repatterning the tone of the breath by just taking three breath cycles that are more slowly, deeply breathing with an emphasis on the real letting go type of out-breath. In just three breath cycles, you can completely retone your nervous system manually from the inside out. No matter what's going on outside you, you can't change that. But you can kind of create your own inner sanctuary with just three breaths. Lastly, for the five techniques, is deep relaxation. So this is my favorite one before bed because it really sets you up for the most restorative REM sleep. So by generally going through each of the muscle groups in your body and then consciously tensing each part, say like the right arm, and then letting it relax, roll it out, move to the next one. And if you systematically go through each muscle group in each part of your body, then you're set up. It's like this magic carpet ride into sleep. And it actually is... been shown to help people heal much more rapidly and to get that sleep that we all so need. And there's been so much talk about, you know, needing less sleep, being more productive. And you can talk so well about the power of sleep and how it helps us detoxify. And but those would be the most powerful techniques that, again, you can do it in three breaths, to take it your idle downtime when you're waiting in line. Even waiting at a traffic light for a moment to just practice conscious breathing.
Great. Very practical. Thank you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've come to the time of the program where we have time for just one last question. So I'm going to ask the same question of each of you, since I know that you follow your own prescriptions, but it can sometimes be hard. So what's the hardest part for each of you of following the program that you recommend? And we'll start with you.
The hardest one. I think probably, this is interesting, I am more of a savory tooth than a sweet tooth. So I think that, you know, the vegetarian, vegan thing for me is it comes down to cheese. And fortunately, it's it's become easier and easier with, there's so many great vegan cheeses, even ones that melt well. So it's become easier and easier. But I think that in the early days, that was probably one of the things I was holding on to. Yeah.
Dean, what about you?
I guess for me, it's actually exercising, surprisingly. I love to meditate. I love to eat healthy. I love to love. But exercise is something that I think it's because I grew up in Texas and exercise was always used as punishment, you know. seriously, like, you know, go take a lap, you know. And so for me, running was always associated with that. So I have a trainer who comes two or three times a week just to motivate me to do it because given a choice, I'll probably avoid it.
Great. We also like to reward and have a little healthy competition. So we call each other true love. So we call it the True Love Olympics every week and who beat each other. So I think that a little.
And if you win, you get to ask
your wish.
You get your wish for anything related to your date that night. So it's highly motivating, I will tell
Wonderful.
You.
Wonderful. I think we better wrap up there. Our thanks to Dr. Dean and Ann Ornish of the Preventive Medicine Institute and co-authors of Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. We also thank everyone here in San Francisco, as well as the audiences on radio, television, and the internet. Thank you for these wonderful questions so many of you submitted. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, and it's also been held in conjunction with the club's Health and Medicine Forum. I want to remind everybody here in San Francisco that copies of our guest's book are on sale, and they will be pleased to sign copies outside of the room immediately following this program. I am Mark Zitter, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.